Good morning from independent Denmark, Ian Lawson. Ian, you've had three blogs this week, differing paths to independence, some of us need to grow up, and so why don't we do this, Nicola? Were these all inspired by the announcement this week by the First Minister?
Yes, yeah, I mean, also a growing intolerance, I would say, within the SNP that, you know, there's a, I mean, Nicola's a first class First Minister, you know, absolutely outstanding. But I mean, for all our great performance in terms of running the government, which is a huge job, she hasn't really made very much progress in a strategic sense on moving the independence debate forward. Now, you can argue, and you know, many people do, that building up support for independence is the first step, and I don't think MD can argue with that. But, you know, people get carried away with what the polls say. I mean, I read regularly, we've never been nearer to independence. Well, I'm sorry, you know, you're not right. The nearest we ever got to independence was in 2014.
Yeah.
We might be at 55% in the polls, but our team haven't got a part to play the game on.
Yeah.
We're not even in the dressing room.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get near to independence when you've got a vote, an imminent vote, right in front of you. Until you get that, you're not near independence.
Mm-hmm. Ian, you mentioned how the NEC has moved position over the years in one of these blogs with regard to what constitutes a mandate. I mean, in the past decade, the previous decade, 56, 35, 48 SNP MPs. In the past, that would have been a mandate to begin negotiations for a velvet divorce, I take it.
All the years I was on the party's NEC, which was over a decade, the party's policy was if we got a majority of seats in the Westminster Parliament, that was a mandate to begin the independence negotiations. Mm-hmm. And it remained that way all the time. It only changed after Gordon Wilson ended being leader and Alex Salmond took over. And at that point, they decided that they would go the referendum route. I think, to be honest, because I think they didn't think at the time they would ever win a majority of the seats in Westminster. So maybe better to go for something that they might actually be able to get. There's always been debate in the SNP over all the years, certainly I was a member, you know, between a gradualist view to achieving independence and a more fundamentalist view. And I mean, my view on reflection over all these years is that both were right, because the two absolutely significant advances in independence have been when the fundamentalists won the argument. The first time round, when it was the Constitutional Convention that was being set up, I was maybe coloured by the fact that I'd been involved in all these steel campaigns and various other campaigns like that, where the Labour Party tactic was to have an all-party campaign. And the minute you were in it, they controlled it because of their numbers. So I was very much of the view that we shouldn't join the Constitutional Convention, that we should stay outside it and put pressure on and force them actually to come up with something meaningful that they wouldn't have come up with had we been members, because they would have just, I mean, they'd already ruled out independence being an option, which was a bit of an insult. You ask a party to join, but you rule before you even start discussing it.
How far back are you going now with the Constitutional Convention discussion?
Right at the start of the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, round about that period. Now, I believe we got the Scottish Parliament, not because of the Constitutional Convention. I believe we got the Scottish Parliament that we've got today because the SNP voted to stay outside it and forced on the parties within the Constitutional Convention to come up with something rather than just talk around the edges. Mm. So that was the first big advance. The second big advance was, of course, 2014, which, well, we didn't win. We led for the first time probably in SNP history a nationwide conversion strategy where we were going out and not, you know, saying we were doing a great job in housing or whatever it happened to be. We were saying, vote for independence, and here's why. Mm. And we, you know, by no stretch of the imagination can you describe it as a failure. We moved from 28% in the polls to 45%. And yeah. I think it justified a lot of our arguments that to win independence, you really need to sell it and you need to actually confront people with the reality of it. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, and that's me blowing up the fundamentalist side, I've got to be fair and say if it wasn't for the gradualist side, we wouldn't have had the referendum in the first place. You know, so both sides were right. It's the usual story. You know, every side in the debate's got a point to make. What I worry about at the moment is there seems to be a cult in the SNP, maybe cult's not the right word, but anybody that suggests anything other than what Nicola's saying is instantly regarded as some sort of rebel or troublemaker or whatever, dissenter. You know, there's no political party in the world that you can agree with every point. And, you know, I believe the best days of the SNP was when there was quite differing views and a lot of issues, but people openly discussed them, debated them, remained friends at the end of it. But, you know, there were pretty stirring debates. Now, if we've lost the ability to even discuss what the way forward is, then that would be a pretty disappointing position to be in.
What's been the reason for that, do you think? Is a sort of growing presidentialism or personality cult politics?
I think that's part, and I think there's also, you know, a fascination with opinion polls. You know, and, you know, opinion polls, yes, they're important, and yes, it's, you know, everybody gets a lift if you get a good opinion poll. But at the end of the day, you need to address some of the very serious mistakes that were made in 2014. Let me give you an example. One of the biggest weaknesses we had in 2014, and it's still there today, is the over 65s. We didn't have an appropriate message. They are the most difficult group in the population to get in contact with, which means if you're going to try and explain a new position, you really need to do it over an extended period of time to have any hope of it having any penetration when the important moment comes. Now, if I had a criticism to say, I would say we've got a yawning open goal on pensions. The UK pension is pathetic, absolutely pathetic. Yet these people were the very target of Better Together. And, you know, they were scared out their pathetic pension. Now, we should be doing far, far more on the yes side to SNOW to educate our pensioner community what all the other countries in the EU get in the way of pensions. Yeah. And we should also be reassuring them and showing to them that Scotland could afford to do the same as, say, Ireland next door or indeed where you are at the moment, you know, in Denmark.
Yeah, Ian, you said in one of your blogs, it's perfectly possible to use another democratic route to independence, minus a Section 30 order. Could you elaborate a wee bit?
Well, I mean, everybody comes back and says we've got to get international recognition for whatever we do. But, you know, there's no rule that it has to be through a referendum. I mean, I accept that a referendum would be the most democratic and clear route, but, you know, we need to equally realise we've got a problem in so much as Westminster don't want us to have that referendum. But if you look at the current makeup of the European Union, there's a host of members who became independent through a parliamentary vote. I mean, the parliament just got together and decided to vote for independence, and it went through. So, you know, I don't worry about this international recognition as much as, you know, a lot of other people do. I mean, I think a lot of people are scared off by what happened in Catalonia. But what happened in Catalonia is a very, very different situation to Scotland. Scotland's in a union as part of a treaty between two southern nations.
Yeah.
Catalonia's unofficial referendum was against the written constitution in the country they were and have always been a member of. Now, it's a different situation altogether. I mean, I think the position of the EU will change quite significantly once this trade deal or non-trade deal, whatever happens with Britain at the end of the year, happens. I mean, I was the honorary consul of Estonia, and I was speaking to the consular representatives of a whole host of countries through the 2014 referendum. And there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that among a great many of them, there was an enormous amount of goodwill towards Scotland. And many of them were very much hoping Scotland would vote yes. Some couldn't contain themselves. The Czech Republic, for instance, came out and said, vote yes. You know, yeah, which probably gave them all heart attacks back in Prague. But, I mean, he was, you know, without getting into any great detail on betrayed confidences, you know, Scandinavia in general was very, very supportive of the idea of an independent Scotland.
They would have been, and people were very surprised here that the result went the way it did, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a disappointment. I mean, I had Estonian newspapers over here and I was taking them round. And I mean, I wasn't setting it up. I was just taking them to, you know, they'd been living in Glasgow. So they asked me where they should go to get some rural ideas of Scotland. And I thought, well, we'll take them down to Argyll, you know. And we took them to Inverary. And they went let loose and they just went themselves and talked to people. And they came back and said, we can't find the MD vote. No. can you take us somewhere where there's some no voters? You know, so I drove them back to Arica. We went into a hotel in Arica. And the only person they could meet that was voting no there was the editor of The Sun. He was sitting with his family. Everybody else in the restaurant were all planning to vote yes. You know, so, but they were shocked, absolutely shocked when it came, because their experience while they'd been here speaking to ordinary people, you know, was that it was going to be substantially yes. You know, so, I mean, I never got any idea. I was with Jim Sillars and Mary Black on the Margomobile for the whole campaign. And we'd taken on the job of going to big housing schemes in Scotland, no matter where they were, and converting them. And, you know, it was going absolutely brilliantly. We were running everywhere we went, with the exception of maybe in Dumfries, went to a housing scheme there that was a bit slightly, maybe no. But the rest of the country, it was overwhelmingly yes. And, you know, it was a big surprise to us on the night that it was a no vote, because it certainly wasn't a no vote where we were campaigning. No.
But there seemed to be a yes momentum. There seemed to be a momentum for yes from my vantage point. And it really felt as though it was going to happen. What turned it?
Well, I think the vow was quite a clever bit of politics by the other side, coming out basically saying we're going to have the most powerful parliament in the world that wasn't actually an independent one, all the rest of it. And I think people that were on the borderline just about to go to yes, that stopped the momentum and said, we'll give them one more chance. Yeah. But I mean, the problem with that type of campaigning is they've left a legacy for him that's trying to defend the union next time round. Because I mean, all these promises were made, none of them were kept. You know, and I mean, that's going to cost them very, very heavily next time if there is a referendum. I mean, I don't believe they'll grant a referendum, because I don't believe they believe they can win one.
No,
I really think that's what the problem is now.
So how does the SNP paint itself out of the corner it's painted itself into? Because Section 30 really is a cul-de-sac.
Well, that was really what my proposal was, a proposal I put forward in my blog, which was to say, well, we send them an ultimatum and we say, we'd like a Section 30, but if it can't be granted in time for the elections next May, then we're going to be going ahead, and that will be our decision. If you want it to be decided on votes rather than seats, then you need to pass that Section 30 immediately. to give us time to organise for that. Now, my argument would be that's hugely democratic. We're seeing it in plenty of time. All the international parties that are interested can see that we've left the door open for it to be based on votes, if Westminster are prepared to do it. If not, however, it can be decided on seats. And even that route would be more democratic, clearer than the route that many of the people are doing the judging, you know, had in their own countries, when their own countries became independent. I mean, Estonia, it was, you know, done by the parliament. You know, they just voted in favour of independence. Admittedly, the tanks were rolling along the street at the time, but it was, you know, a parliamentary vote, and that was it done at that stage.
This is very much Craig Murray's argument as well, that a national convention could be called of all the elected officials and a vote held.
Yes, well, Craig Murray's argument was that the members of the Scottish Parliament, the Scottish MPs at Westminster, and the Scottish MEPs should all get together and vote on it. And that would be, you know, democratic by any criteria. We don't have any Scottish MEPs anymore. So, you know, we've lost that arm of it. So, but I mean, there's no reason why. It would be a substantial majority that would vote in favour of it as well. It wouldn't be, you know, marginal. I mean, if you could argue, you know, it should only be constituency MPs in the Scottish Parliament as well. So, you know, it would be minuscule, the opposition, if you think about it.
Very much so. Ian, where do you stand on another independence party, ISP, Independence for Scotland
party? Well, I mean, I would never join another political party. I'm not a member of any political party now, largely because I write my blog and I want to be independent of any of them to do that. But I think they've got problems. I mean, in paper it sounds a great idea, but you need a certain gravitas, a certain level of credibility, I think, to get votes. It'd be a completely different thing if somebody, for instance, like Alex Salmond, decided he wanted to return to the Scottish Parliament and he was to set up a party or lead one of the existing parties. That would be a serious challenge and that would win seats without any question. I don't think there's any doubt about that, because the other criteria, and I say this is something that used to be in charge of the SNP's fundraising, you know, you need a lot of money for elections. And these new parties, I don't see any big funders coming forward to say they're going to put up the sort of money that you would require to make an impact. I wish them well in some ways, because I mean, it's widening the debate. If I was to give them advice, I would say, don't listen to the SNP saying, where's your policies? Because the only reason the SNP want to know where your policies is, so they can pull them apart. It's the first tactics in politics. With every party, where's your policies? All right, thanks very much. We'll now destroy you, but over your policies. Have 5 or 6 bullet points, stick to them, and you'll be fine in the debates. But I'm not confident anything will come of it. I think the Greens will probably do quite well still, because despite making a couple of political mistakes, in the main, they've been reasonably supportive.
Yeah, they have. You talk about an unused mandate cupboard in the SNP HQ.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's the biggest cupboard in the building, I'm told. You know, but I mean, you can't keep coming along. I mean, people joke about the grand old Duke of York, but I mean, you can't keep leading your army up the hill and then once you get to the top of the hill, sitting having a picnic and then coming back down. You know, sooner or later, you're going to have to fight a battle. And, you know, this argument, it's a lot of diminishing returns. You know, originally, you know, nobody could argue when the SNP said, give us a mandate and we'll do something about this. They were given the mandate. They've now got, I think, 6 mandates, you know, so, and they haven't really pushed any of them. And what the danger with this is, again, I mean, everybody got excited last week, but Nicola said nothing that she hadn't said before. There was no timescale given. She's going to tell us next spring what the timescale is. Well, you know, I mean, there's a huge difference between I'll deal with it and we'll have a referendum in the first year of office or in the term of the next parliament. That's a huge difference. You know, so we need to know that sort of information. And frankly, I think they'll just delay it again. You know, I don't think Nicola personally has the drive and ambition to be the leader that took Scotland to independence in the same way Alex Salmond had.
That's maybe unfair. How do you see her position then?
I see Nicola, I mean, I don't doubt she wants independence, but I don't think she's a risk taker. You know, and I think no matter, you know, whether the polls are at 55%, 60% or whatever, an independence referendum is a risk. And I think Nicola's natural caution leads her to want, you know, as good a guarantee as she could possibly get that she could win it. Now, that's understandable. Yeah. It is important, you know. But, you know, you can miss the opportunity as well. People seem to presume, because the polls have been going up quite steadily, they'll continue to do that. Now, I agree with them at the moment. It looks likely because we'll get Brexit at the end of the year. Almost certainly no trade deal. We've got COVID been mishandled, badly mishandled. So the chances are good that the polls will continue to roll at this stage. But at some point, the polls are only good for you if you use and grab the opportunity. If you allow them just to waver on, I mean, there is undoubtedly dissatisfaction within the Yes movement. There's a frustration. There's considerable annoyance in some parts that we're still talking about yet another mandate. You know, they hope to be well by this yet another mandate stage. And they're not, and that's a problem. And it won't be allowed to go on terribly much longer, I don't think, without there being repercussions within the party.
Could there be a split? I think
there's a lot of concern about the NEC and the party. And, I mean, that's going to explode sooner or later. The party's quite lucky that they're having a virtual conference this year, because I think if it was a full-blown normal conference, there would be a lot of trouble, because some people have been very naughty, and that's the nicest thing I can say about it.
And, Kevin McKenna describes it as a party within the party.
Absolutely. Well, it's entryism. There's no question. If you look at the three problem areas, problem area over the vetting panel, who appear to be running the selection of candidates based on is it a woke seat or is it not a woke seat? If their group have got a candidate going, the job of the vetting panel is to get rid of all the credible candidates that might stand against that person for that seat. That's what happened in Stirling when Alan Smith got in and selected there. They effectively removed his main challenger, who had been the previous MP there.
Can I just ask you, a lot of people don't quite understand the whole concept of, you know, don't vote woke or woke MPs contra sort of normal MPs.
Yeah.
How would you describe it? Because I think there's a lot in the party faithful who are a bit outside this whole debate.
Well, I mean, there's an agenda. These people are driving an agenda which includes, you know, the Gender Recognition Act, the hate crime bill, you know. And most people in the SNP are in there for one reason and one reason only, which is to have their independence. And they really don't want to be fighting in the doorstep with people about Gender Recognition Acts and hate crime bills, particularly when we're doing well in the polls, because the automatic reaction of most Scots, rightly or wrongly, to those issues is they don't want to know anything about them. They just don't want them, simple as that. And, you know, a lot of it is unnecessary. I mean, Scots common law, existing common law, covers much of what's in the hate crime bill. But we've managed to remarkably unite a wall of opposition to the SNP government. I mean, who else could the United Free Church of Scotland, the Roman Catholic Church, and the Orange Order, all on the one side. You know,
seems incredible.
You can add to that.
It seems incredible.
You know, it is incredible. But I mean, why would you drive these things? Whose agenda is this that you're pursuing? It's not an independence, because these are divisive policies. Mm. I mean, similarly, you know, the absolutely outrageous behaviour of the women that were involved in the plotting, smearing of Alex Salmond, and who, even after a jury of their peers, a majority of whom were women, threw out every single charge, they continued to go to the media, continued to attack and smear Alex Salmond, despite the fact they'd been proven to be liars by the court. You know, it's absolutely outrageous. And, you know, this is where it all gets very interesting, because it's a very small group of people that are involved in all these same issues, involved in trying to smear Alex Salmond, involved in trying to control the NEC and the vetting committee, you know, driving this woke agenda.
Okay.
It's all the same people.
Okay. Well, as long as we don't jigsaw them out of that.
The problem is.
As long as we don't jigsaw them out of that.
I've not mentioned names.
I've no idea who they are at all, but
you can go and look.
Okay. Okay.
I know who they are.
And
but I'm not telling you in your program.
No, not at all. Ian, can we go back to Estonia? You know, this flag here, yes. If you can see it, has a relation to Estonia.
I know. You named the capital Reval. It was Tallinn used to be called Reval.
Ah. Okay.
And it was a Danish city at the time.
Yeah, the Danish kings had a claim on Estonia.
Well, they do, yep. I agree with that. I mean, I've heard that before. Sweden claims them all the Baltic countries. but if you go to Estonian museums, they're not slow to point out the role that Denmark played in their history, you know. So I completely accept that the Danes played a major role in the development of Estonia.
Yeah, the funny thing about the flag is that it's supposed to have fallen down. It's a myth from the sky during a battle in 1219 in Estonia, which is incredible.
Right, well, we've got stories like that about how the saltire came about as well, you know. Yeah. The sky's been very productive for flags.
Yeah. Ian, were you in any of the Baltic countries during the independence events?
No, I was very, very early into Estonia. I came into Estonia in May 1993. So it was after their independence, but the Soviet troops were still there. It was still occupied. The Russian soldiers had not left Tallinn at that point. And it was pretty much turmoil for the first 18 months, 2 years after independence anyway, just simply because you know, the Russians were pulling out a lot of the state enterprises that they had in Tallinn. So Estonia is wonderful these days.
Do you go back?
I mean, I'm there all the time. I'm a regular visitor to Estonia. Not as much as I used to be. I used to stay there 1 week every month.
Okay.
And I did that from 93 until 2008, 2009. You know, and then I probably visit Estonia 4 times a year at the moment, you know. I've got a lot of friends that are there. So there's some very good Scots, like yourself, exiled Scots, in Estonia, who have been quite successful business-wise.
Okay. With the independence debate, do you have any predictions for next year?
Well, I mean, I think as things stand, the SNP should sweep the board next May. I hope they do. I would anticipate it will be a SNP majority government. I hope the Greens do well as well, and I hope there's far fewer unionists in the Scottish Parliament than there currently is. At the moment, I think Labour are in desperate trouble. I mean, yeah, they can't get rid of their leader, never mind winning the election. I mean, it's quite appalling to watch,
It's become a comedy.
The thing is, it's only really a good idea to get rid of a leader if you've got somebody that's going to be better to come along. And I don't know who they think is going to be better looking at that Labour group. You know, the Tories have had their hopes dashed entirely. I mean, I think they hoped that bringing back Davidson, she'd get a free run in the media again, like she got the first time round, and that she'd be able to take on Nicola. And I mean, the First Minister's question so far, if it'd been a boxing match, it'd get stopped, you know, because like Nicola's just hammering her with her seat in the House of Lords, and there's nothing she can say, you know, in reply. So that's not working out. I think Duncan Ross, leader over the water, or down the other end of the M6 or whatever. I don't think he's up to much. He's in a good mood for Duncan Ross, because I mean he'll be first in the Highland list, so he'll get back into Parliament. I'm not so sure if some of his colleagues will. You know, we'll see how it goes. But
Some people are suggesting Ian Murray might. He's a very dedicated unionist. He might stand as a Labour leader in the way as an MP, the way Douglas Ross has.
Well, Doug Ross, of course, is standing as a leader, but MP, but he's going to stand down come next May. I mean, Ian Murray, fine if Ian Murray wants to go for it, that's fine. But what do they do in the Scottish Parliament? Because he's not a member.
He'd have to stand down, obviously, in Westminster as well. Yeah.
See, he'd have the same problem, you know, as Duncan Ross is going to have. So, I mean, I don't see that. I mean, I think the events are much more interesting down south as well. I mean, I don't see Boris being around. If I could get a bet anywhere that he wouldn't be around at the end of 2021, I'd definitely take it, because I think he'll be removed shortly after the no deal fiasco comes up at the end of the year. I think pretty early on 2021, he'll probably get ditched and he'll take the blame, or the idea will be he'll take the blame for Brexit with him. But and that's why I think the Chancellor probably is quite a serious, credible alternative, because I don't think you could have somebody like Gove, or Dominic Raab. They all seem too much to be close to Brexit. So I think they need someone that was a wee bit more distant as the alternative to Boris. But I mean, everybody's got their problems. The only leadership contest we're not talking about, and justifiably so, is Nicola, because I think Nicola's quite secure for as long as she wants to stay there. But I think that position will change in the next Parliament. If she wasn't to move on independence. But between her and Peter, her husband running as chief executive, they've got a pretty strong hold on the party, would be a kind way of putting it. I don't see any great rebellions, because the people with the gravitas and maybe the news to create a problem or two are standing down, you know. Mike Russell, for instance, would have been a good leader, in my opinion, of the SNP, being totally credible. But, you know, people of that standing down makes it more difficult see alternatives, you know.
Very much so, yeah. There could be fallout from the committee and the fallout from the trial.
Yes, yeah, well, I mean, Alex Salmond's not given his evidence yet.
No.
You know, that there'll be a few newspapers turning up that day, I suspect. I'm told, I haven't seen any of this evidence, but I'm told a lot of it is in the form of emails. You know, and it's quite difficult to misrepresent emails. if you're caught on an email planning a plot, you've got a problem. You know, and I believe that there are there is quite a lot of written evidence to substantiate that there was indeed a plot. Mm. I mean, people in the party wonder what could the plot possibly be about?
Mm.
And I mean, I can tell you this much. The plot was about the incident in the Parliament with Mark MacDonald and him being accused of retweeting something that was sexually inappropriate. He never wrote it, he just retweeted it.
I see.
But the woke element decided they had to go. And no sooner had they decided to go than they started to worry about him going, because they thought that that would cause a by-election up in Aberdeen.
Mm.
And Alex Salmond may decide he wanted to re-enter Holyrood, and they were providing him with a route.
Mm.
This is where basically the woke brakes were immediately put on. Nobody wanted Mark MacDonald to resign anymore. All mention of Mark MacDonald resigning was thrown into the bin. Mm. He was to stay on, but he'd just be outside the group. No need for a by-election.
Yeah.
But this was all measures, and this whole plot was measures to stop Alex Salmond being able to become the candidate there. Mm. That explains why there's comments in writing from a member of staff at headquarters saying, oh, that's good, we've got that, we'll keep that in case we need it. You know, in other words, to keep him off the candidate selection process. We'll only use that if we need to stuff, you know. So it was, that evidence is definitely out there, you know, and it will, I'm sure, at some point materialise. I hear conflicting reports. I mean, I don't speak to Alec myself, so I've got no first-hand accounts, but some people tell me he is writing a book, and some people tell me he is, but he's not started writing it yet. It may well be that that would be the sensible thing to do, wait and see what comes out of these committees and then start writing at that point. But
yeah.
I'm sure at some point he will write a book. And, you know, the story from his point of view will come out.
Yeah.
I always liked Denmark, by the way, because Denmark in the airport at Copenhagen was where I used to buy books that were banned or had court orders on them in Britain. Like, for instance, Robert Maxwell, if you remember.
Yeah.
I bought a book about Robert Maxwell in Copenhagen Airport. And it was quite interesting. The girl that was serving me told me it was one of the best sellers, but it was a book that was banned in Britain because Maxwell had been able to get a court order to stop it being published. And it was absolutely full of all the things which materialised as the truth once he was dead.
He
had a very successful legal campaign to stop it coming out. So I always have a look around the bookstall in Copenhagen Airport as my recommendation. You know, you can often pick up a good book that you can't buy in Britain.
Yeah. It's a very strong part of the Danish constitution, the freedom of speech.
Absolutely.
It's
rightly so.
Yeah. They're very, very big on that. Absolutely. Listen, Ian, fabulous to talk to you. Nice we got the camera. Nice we got the camera level.
Once we overcame our technical difficulties, as they say, it all was very smooth, Peter. Very good.
Very good.
Okay.
Ian, are you, you got some blogs coming up next week?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm going to do an article in Currency at the start of the week, because I've been getting a lot of people writing saying, tell us about Currency. What's your views in Currency?
Mm.
So I'm by no means a Currency expert, but I did go through it twice in Estonia, you know, moving from one currency to the other.
Yeah.
And I was running businesses at the time. So the first message I've got is it's not anything as exciting as you just like to make out.
No, not at all.
It's a lot of nonsense. I mean, if you take when Estonia joined the euro, they operated dual currencies for 2 weeks. It was all over at the end of that. And to this day, if your granny dies in Tallinn and you go in and start clearing out the house and you discover under the mattress a vast cache of Estonian kroons, you can still put them in the wheelbarrow and drive them down to the bank and you'll get the exact same exchange rate from the banks there in euros, as happened on the day they swapped the currency over.
They still do that?
Yes, to this day. And it's remarkable. They have actually passed. There is no time limit. Wow. There will never be any time limit in being able to do that. So there you go.
Incredible.
So you can do that when you're just a small country with your own currency.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I mean, there's lots of funny stories about that, because, you know, when the historians suggested that they were going to, you know, tie their currency, this little tiny country with 1.3 million, and they were going to tie it, of all currencies, to the Deutschmark, you know, which at the time was the largest economy in Europe and by far the most productive. Everybody, all the experts, the financial experts, were all saying, madness, it'll never work, it'll never work. They pegged it to 8-1, it stayed there until the Germans surrendered and joined the Euro. So, I mean, just a lot of nonsense.
Yeah. And look forward to that, Ian.
Okay.
Keep the blogs coming. Keep the blogs coming.
Don't worry, they'll be coming okay.
Thanks a lot.
Enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you.